You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of January 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, it's still 2 hours until polls close in Israel, but at the risk of perpetrating Monocle 24's own Dewey defeats Truman moment, it will be a considerable surprise if anyone but Benjamin Netanyahu ends up leading the next government. We'll have the latest from Tel Aviv.
The main issue that the Israeli government should strive to bring a resolution to is the conflict with the Palestinians, which is obviously, you know, shadows our budget and our ability to move forward in other fields.
In Mali, have France's ambitions of a limited military adventure already been overtaken by events in neighbouring Algeria? We'll ask why Norway, of all countries, might be among those sending troops to the West African desert, and have a report from one Malian town recently recovered from the Islamists.
It seems pretty clear that the Islamists right now are on the back foot, that the French airstrikes are having a great effect, and with support of French ground troops, the Mali army is beginning to take back some of the territory that it's lost over the last year.
Also ahead, everybody knows that China's economy is big and growing, but it's far from certain how big or how fast. We'll meet one of the editors of a newish publication which aims to disinter the truth about China and find out what he knows that nobody else does. We'll speak to Adam Lankford, author of The Myth of Martyrdom, who believes he might have an answer to one of the questions which has plagued our age. How do you wage war against someone who doesn't care whether they live or die? Plus, we'll ask if the markets are right to be optimistic about the new BlackBerry, find out why France's National Library wants to spend millions on pornography, and play some music too, all coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But ahead of all that, the latest world news with Jonathan Wheatley.
Prosecutors have called for a stiffer sentence for former Liberian President Charles Taylor today, telling war crimes judges in The Hague that he played a direct role in crimes against humanity during the civil war in Sierra Leone. Taylor's defence lawyer, Christopher Gosnell, who wants his conviction overturned, said that the conviction was played with internal inconsistencies.
And I regret to say that the prosecutor is wrong to say that it is unusual for crimes to be committed in bloody civil wars. Unfortunately, it is all too common. It is going on, and it has been documented as going on now by both sides in Syria. It is going on in Pakistan. It is going on in Sudan. It is going on in many other countries that are supported, in some cases, by the very sponsors of this court.
Israelis have voted in surprisingly high numbers today in a general election expected to hand Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a third term in office and bolster opponents of Palestinian statehood. However, the strong turnout has buoyed centre-left parties, which had pinned their hopes on energising an army of undecided voters against Netanyahu and his nationalist religious allies. A majority of European Union finance ministers voted today to allow Germany, France and nine other Eurozone countries to prepare to introduce a tax on financial transactions. The Irish finance minister Michael Noonan, whose country currently holds the six-month rotating EU presidency, said discussions on the content of the tax will continue to be open to all 27 member states.
The issue of the single market is also a consideration. A tax cannot be put in place which will run counter to the principles or the practice, indeed, of the single market. So it's not a straightforward issue, and it will involve significant negotiation among the member states, including those member states who don't wish to participate at present.
On the day after Washington, D.C. was bustling with inauguration events to ring in President Barack Obama's second term, residents of the nation's capital were evaluating how it compared to his first inauguration 4 years ago. For Washington resident Brian Masser, Obama's speech was the focal point of the events.
President Obama's speech. I thought it was an interesting departure in terms of tone. I thought compared to the last inauguration, he was a lot more commanding, I'd say, this time. He set out a much more broad policy agenda that really spoke to kind of a togetherness and a unity that we need to use to address the problems confronting our country.
Women in Delhi are taking self-defense classes following the brutal gang rape and murder of a physiotherapy student last month. The assault on the 23-year-old stunned the nation and generated an unprecedented wave of protests calling for better security for women. Kapoor is an instructor.
Situation has changed, crime has changed, and the street is full of surprise. So end of the day, we have to train ourselves as close to reality for surprise.
And finally, a prank note in an Australian library declaring that disgraced cyclist Lance Armstrong's books would be moved to the fiction section has gone viral on the internet, with one commentator declaring, "Hell hath no fury like a Liberian." The sign was posted at the Manly Library, that's near Sydney in New South Wales. And that's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. That's Manly Library, the first library for which I ever held a library card.
Really?
Yep, long time ago, mid-70s, just across the road from where I started school, Manly Public School, Sydney. Fine institution. Anyway, it's 6 minutes past 1800 hours here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And you are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. It looks like Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will be re-elected, albeit with a smaller majority. Netanyahu's Likud party will nigh certainly eventually be joined by other right-wing parties in a new governing coalition. That is, of course, pending the outcome of today's elections in Israel. The apparent triumph of the Israeli right in this election and the relative quiet of the Israeli left during the campaign seems to signal a shift in the priorities of Israeli voters. The election has been dominated not by the eternal existential question of Israel's security and relationship with its Palestinian neighbours, but by more workaday domestic considerations, budget cuts, cost of living and housing. Earlier today, Monocle 24 was at a polling station in Tel Aviv to see how some citizens were planning to cast their vote.
I don't mind sharing. I voted for Meretz, which is the left-wing Israeli government. I agree with some of the statements of this party, and I often think they're more consistent than other parties in our Knesset. This specific elections, from the experience that I have, were actually quite good. Issues that had to be spoken out were discussed in the media and between the people, and I think in general it was good feeling about these elections. The main issue that the Israeli government should strive to bring a resolution to is the conflict with the Palestinians, which is obviously, you know, shadows our budget and our ability to move forward in other fields. I think that, you know, once you try to do something over again and again and you hit it like a brick wall, so people are kind of like, in a way, despaired, and they rather put the light and focus on other things. But I think the majority understand this is the main issue and just rather, you know, focus on other things, because it seems like the solution is impossible to find.
Who did you vote for today?
For Balad, primarily because they're the only party that I found that stands for liberal democratic principles. The fact that the Israeli regime controls so many people that don't have democratic rights under it, and how they're going to deal with that, whether it be reaching a two-state solution or including the entire populace that it controls. It's been clear that there's been a shift to the right, which expect to see in the results tonight and tomorrow.
Who did you vote for?
Netanyahu. Because I think he's the only one that could be the prime minister for now. It's a difficult times, but I think every prime minister will be handling all the issues and pressure. So I think it will be the best job he will do it. I don't like the sort of election. You can only vote for a party, not for the prime minister. So I almost didn't vote, but I prefer it will be for a party and prime minister. I hope everything will be steady, maybe to get along more of the issues with the Palestinians and the foreigners and the refugees issues. What I hope is that the economy will be stable, more stable. This is my issue.
And we can cross now to Monocle's Joseph Dana, who's in Tel Aviv. Joseph, first of all, I wanted to talk about the somewhat startling exit poll results, which suggests that Yair Lapid's Yesh Atid party might rather have snuck up on everybody.
Indeed, this is the kind of late-breaking news so far, and that is that the kind of center-left parties seem to be surging in this last-minute round of voting. And it should be noted that the real story this evening in Israel is the fact that upwards of 55% of eligible voters have already voted. And this is up from 5% during the last elections in 2009. And so we're seeing that the Israeli people are really coming out to the polls. And this, you know, probably because of the real social implications of this election, talking about these economic issues, this has really driven a lot of people to the polls, as well as the fact that it was an absolutely beautiful day across Israel, and so people are kind of just enjoying the weather, and it's a national holiday during election time.
Does this mean that an extension of Benjamin Netanyahu's premiership might not be the foregone conclusion people were anticipating?
It doesn't appear that way. Likud right now is kind of sending out a lot of warning messages to its party supporters, saying, you know, we're fearing that we're losing a lot of seats, and so you really have to go out and vote now if you haven't already. But what they're saying is that they're going down to somewhere around 29 seats, which would still see Netanyahu as the next prime minister of Israel. And so it looks like his kind of hold on this position is relatively firm, but we are seeing this surging kind of center-left coalition, which will really make the next steps all the more interesting in terms of figuring out how this next government is going to look and going to function.
You know, in most international coverage of the election, Monocle 24 is not excluded. The rising star of Israeli politics was supposed to be Naftali Bennett of Jewish home. Maybe you need to balance that a bit for us right now by telling us a little bit about who Yair Lapid is and what Yesh Atid stand for.
Well, Yair Lapid is a very famous television journalist in Israel, and he announced quite some time ago that he was going to jump into politics and kind of, you know, shake things up a little bit and take advantage of the breakup of the Kadima party. And so he's actually brought in a couple of other longstanding Israeli politicians, including Yaakov Peri, who was the Shin Bet director during the first Intifada. And as we're seeing tonight, this message of bringing in these kind of older politicians and with Yair Lapid as their face, it seems to be working. But, you know, Naftali Bennett's party is still looking as though it's going to have a very, very strong showing. And so the right wing that we've been talking so much about is not going away. It's just that they're going to be a little bit more kind of weighted from the center-left coalition.
How formidable an opponent to a right-wing government might Lapid prove? Or, I guess, on how many issues would he be broadly on their side?
Well, it's difficult to say. He's during this very long election process, especially for Lapid, who's been in the race for quite some time now, he's suffered a lot of different scandals, and there's been a bit of mistrust about his background as a journalist and whatnot. And so, you know, it's still very early in terms of whether or not Yesh Atid is going to prove as strong as it's proving right now. And we really have to temper, especially at this hour, with the polls still open for a couple of more hours, what, you know, the different parties are saying. And I think, you know, I received just two text messages on my Israeli phone saying, you know, it's time to get out and vote, and, you know, Labor is suffering and Likud is suffering. And so it's a bit of a chaotic situation.
So just finally, Joseph, how long do you think we need to wait before a reasonably coherent picture of Israel's thinking develops?
Well, a reasonably coherent picture of Israeli thinking could be sometime in the process, but in terms of getting the results tonight, we should have pretty concrete exit polling by 10 o'clock local time. So around midnight in Israel, I think we're going to have a really clear picture as to whether or not Lapid's party, Yesh Atid, and the Labor Party, and as well Meretz, who the person at the polling station voted for, whether or not these parties actually had a kind of late burst in the race and were able to reassert a little bit of power in this race that's really been dominated by these, you know, kind of grandiose right-wing politicians that we've been speaking so much about.
Joseph Dana in Tel Aviv, thank you as ever for joining us. Coming up, the international intervention in Mali gathers momentum. And Norway soldiers about to swap their snow goggles for sunblock.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week, we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion, and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we round up the menswear collections in Paris, take the heat of the German construction industry at Bau in Munich, we drop in on the Bata Shoe Museum in Toronto, and learn how to make a fragrance in Paris.
I've got my pipette, I've already put in some wood and some musk, and I'm now adding the amber, drop by drop.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Last week's ambitious assault on a gas facility in Algeria was a bracing reminder, if one were needed, that Islamist militancy in North Africa is not confined to the northern deserts of Mali. In fact, given how many of Al-Qaeda's early 21st century legions learned their trade during Algeria's ghastly civil war in the 1990s, there is an argument that this is merely the war on terror turning full circle. Accordingly, more and more countries are beginning to consider the wisdom of signing up for France's Malian expedition. The British government is contemplating stepping up its transport and surveillance assistance at the very least, and perhaps more surprisingly, Norway, five of whose citizens are still missing in Algeria, is considering sending troops. We'll discuss this in more detail presently, but first an update from Mali by Monocle's Nairobi correspondent Tristan McConnell, who has just left the town of Diabali, recently retaken by French and Malian troops.
The French advance, or French-led advance in Mali, seems to be gathering some steam now. I've just been in a town called Diabali, which is in central Mali. I was there for most of today. And there was clear evidence that the French airstrikes on the town have been effective at stopping the Islamist advance and forcing them to turn tail, but also very effective at not damaging civilian property or taking any civilian lives. So it really was quite an impressive display. There were a lot of incinerated Islamist battle wagons, if you like, on the outside of town, a fair bit of war damage, but very directed in the place where it was supposed to go. And none of the civilians I spoke to said that there'd been any casualties or damage to their property. So they're doing quite a good job of not alienating the civilian population, which is always a worry when you have a foreign force here. But it's not just in Diabali where the advances are taking place. Another town called Doenza, which the Islamist groups have been holding for a few months, has, we're told, been retaken by the Mali army with the support of the French. Now, we're not actually able to get there to verify that information for ourselves because the army is currently blocking journalists from visiting the area, but I'm hoping I'll be able to go there tomorrow and see exactly what's going on the ground. So, in short, it seems pretty clear that the Islamists right now are on the back foot, that the French airstrikes are having a great effect, and with the support of French ground troops, a lot of French ground troops in the lead, the Mali army is beginning to take back some of the territory that it's lost over the last year.
And joining me now to discuss Norway's potential involvement is Morten Boas from the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. Morten, why would Norway put its hand up for this?
Probably several reasons for this. Norway has for quite some time being actually contemplated stepping up its Africa involvement within the field of peacekeeping operations, peace and security operations. So it's partly within the line of that kind of thinking, but clearly, I mean, the eagerness to join forces with the international partners in Mali and Northern Mali in particular has been greatly enhanced by the terrorist attack in Algeria. There is absolutely no doubt about it. It's pretty clear that there has been conversations within the government coalition about sort of increasing Norway's presence also on the ground in Africa on issues concerning peacekeeping, peace and security operations, but almost unison, seemingly consensus on Norway joining in one way or another would not have happened that fast if it had not been for the attack in Algeria. That said, we do have a coalition government, and one of the parties, the Socialist Left Party, is still has some doubts about this. So it will probably still go some time until the issue is finally decided in Norway.
What kind of role would Norwegian troops play? It's just that sort of baking hot desert doesn't strike most people, I wouldn't have thought, as the most natural environment for Norwegian soldiers.
No, I think that the Norwegian involvement will depend a lot upon what kind of operation this actually ends up as, and also what kind of involvement and role there will be for the African force that is to join this. A lot of the debate in Norway will be decided upon that. If this ends up as yet another hunt for terrorists and hunt for terrorists only this time in the Malian desert, I think that there will be more skepticism in Norway with regards to joining this. On the other hand, if this ends up with a process where there are military means are applied, but there is also a broad spectrum of the political process involved, I think then I see more of a role for Norway. As an actor within, for instance, joining forces with Sweden with regard to the EU training mission. This is the training mission that will sort of help train both some of the African peacekeeping force that will come, but also help, and that is very much needed, some retraining of the army. I heard from your correspondent that he was quite impressed with some of the displays that the Malian army now have shown in combat and also with regard to the civilian population. The problem is that that's only one part of the story. There are stories coming out of the town of Kana, which also was retaken very recently. And this is also confirmed by Amnesty and Human Rights Watch about human rights offenses by the Malian army towards what they see as possible hostile civilian population. This time it was towards the Fulani population in the area. So that's also part of the problem, and this will be very much part of the discussion in Norway, I think.
The Norwegian military has deployed overseas in recent years as part of multinational enterprises in Bosnia, Kosovo, Afghanistan, Iraq, among other places. Are these deployments generally popular with the Norwegian public?
That is overstating it. I think that the majority of the Norwegians initially, if not in favor, understood that we had to stand by our international commitments, in particular to our relationship to the U.S. with regard to Afghanistan. The whole Iraq thing was highly unpopular in Norway, and Norway didn't contribute much at all either. I think that the Bosnian operation and Balkan operations were quite widely supported, and some of the other more peacekeeping missions as well has a quite high public support. It depends on how this will be played out in the political debate. As I said, if this is seen by possible opposition forces to such commitments by Norway as first and foremost a hunt for terrorists, as a military operation without a more pragmatic political side to it, I think there will be opposition in Norway to this, and it may be, in fact, quite difficult for the current coalition government to get this through, because we are heading into, this is an election year, and this is an issue on which the Socialist Left Party may choose to show independence from the rest from their majority partner in the coalition government, the Labour Party.
Morten Boas from the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, thank you very much for joining us. Coming up, we'll have an update on the state of China. Welcome back to Midori House. It's 18:24 in London, which is 2:24 in the morning in Beijing. There was a time, not as long ago as it might seem, when the book one consulted to understand what was occurring inside the People's Republic of China was Little and Red. Today, Mao's collected ravings are but souvenir shop stock, and the book that tells the story of modern China is Beige, although more interesting than that makes it sound. The China Beige Book is a quarterly publication launched in 2012, which illuminates the real state state of China's economy through interviews with hundreds of senior executives and bankers. The hope is that the Beige Book will provide a more accurate picture of China's economy than official government statistics, which are not notably more close to the truth than the bulletins extolling record tractor production issued during the Cultural Revolution. Well, joining us now from our New York bureau is Leland Miller, president of CBB International and one of the editors of the China Beige Book. Thanks for joining us. First of all, why beige?
Well, the book itself is modeled off the Federal Reserve's Beige Book, which is the colloquial name for the long summary of economic conditions. I'm not sure I even remember the title, but people forgot it themselves in the United States. They started calling it the Beige Book because the first iterations of it were beige. And because the methodology was modeled off the Federal Reserve's Beige Book, we adopted that into our title to let people know that this wasn't just a regular type of survey, that it was a survey that incorporated both quantitative and qualitative elements across the entire country over time. And we're hoping that, the name resonates with people who are familiar with decades of the Federal Reserve's Beige Book.
In the year or so you've been operating the China Beige Book, what's the greatest discrepancies you've noted between China's official statistics and reality, as you found from your interviews?
Well, it's really slow. The data, official data, lags. There's a huge debate about how reliable data is, whether it's politically manipulated. These are all questions, very valid questions. But the one thing that is not in dispute is that the information is late. If you look at what the United States has done, you know, we've been collecting GDP data for, 70 years. It takes the United States at least 4 weeks to compute GDP at the end of every quarter. You know, Hong Kong, which is 7 million people, small land area, it takes Hong Kong at least 6 weeks to compute the GDP data for the quarter. Now, if you look at what the Chinese do, they start releasing this within with under 2 weeks. It's just not possible. And the way they do it is by taking older time periods and not focusing on the actual three months that are the focus of the quarter. So you have, even if the data is real, it's old.
How do Chinese authorities feel about your Beige Book?
Well, we haven't had any problems yet, knock on wood. But I think one of the more interesting things to view this through is in the second quarter, when everyone was saying that the Chinese economy was a mess, hard landing was imminent, the political leadership was in disarray. You had all the gloom and doom stories, as bad as they've been in the past 3 years. We came out with something saying, actually, the Chinese economy is strengthening modestly. So our data was far more upbeat than even the official data was. And the reason for this is that we get our data fresh. It's as soon as we get it, we bring it out and publish it, provide it to our clients. So this information was fresh. And when the third quarter came around and the official data suddenly registered this unexpected rebound, this is information that we had been talking about for months before that. So it would have been a little bit difficult for them to come out and say, stop telling us we're doing too good a job. So we've been okay so far.
Your methodology does rely on those hundreds and hundreds of interviews with bankers and senior executives. Do you find that people in those positions in China are generally happy to talk candidly?
Well, this is our biggest surprise at the beginning, because the survey wouldn't work if we weren't getting real answers. And you're getting real answers because after a certain amount of time, either everyone is smiling and happy, or everyone's depressed, or what you're reporting doesn't reflect what happens over time. So we actually started this project off back in 2010 and worked pretests and tried to figure out what people would tell us and what they wouldn't. And we were quite amazed that people actually are willing to talk. There's actually a very sophisticated economic survey culture in China right now. And we were able to get far more information from C-suite execs, from bank loan managers, from everyone across the economy, far more than we ever would have thought.
Leland Miller, president of CBB International and one of the editors of the China Beige Book, joining us from our New York bureau. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Van uit London, dit is Monocle 24.
Way you London. This is Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London,
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we'll have a crack at answering one of the great unanswerables of our time, the motivation of the suicidal killer. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thank you very much. Israelis have voted in surprisingly high numbers today in a general election expected to hand Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu a third term in office and bolster opponents of Palestinian statehood. Prosecutors have called for a stiffer sentence for former Liberian President Charles Taylor, telling war crimes judges in The Hague today that he played a direct role in crimes against humanity during the civil war in Sierra Leone. A majority of European Union finance ministers voted today to allow Germany, France and nine other Eurozone countries to prepare to introduce a tax on financial transactions. And women in Delhi are taking self-defence classes following the brutal gang rape and murder of a physiotherapy student last month. The assault on the 23-year-old stunned the nation and generated an unprecedented wave of protests calling for better security for women. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Лондрис, Нова Йорк, Токио.
Лондон, Нью Йорк, Токио. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. It's 1831 here in London. It has been a bumpy couple of years for Research in Motion. The manufacturers of the BlackBerry have floundered so severely that those of us who write scripts for Current Affairs Radio have all but run out of jokes about BlackBerry spreading themselves too thin, conserving their market, fruitless hunt for new customers, and obviously the one about being in a jam. However, all that might be about to change. A range of new handsets is due at the end of this month, loaded with a new operating system, and the markets, at least, are optimistic. Shares in RIM have surged to a 13-month high, up more than 15%, though still 90% short of their 2008 peak, which tells us something about the ground BlackBerry needs to recover. Well, joining us now is Monocle's resident tech expert, David Field. And David, welcome back.
Thank you.
Why all the excitement?
I think it's because the BlackBerry operating system has sort of stalled, and BlackBerry admit this, that there was nowhere further for it to go. So they, some couple of years ago, bought a company called the QNX that would provide them with the new software that would be enough to take them forward. And next week, we'll see whether it really is. And certainly what I've seen of it is fantastic and is very impressive. I think BlackBerry's problem, just to put it in context, is this thing called BYOD, bring your own device, that people used to have their own phone and a work...
The work BlackBerry.
Exactly. Yeah. And as their own phone became more proficient and smarter, they suddenly found they could do emails on it, and so they didn't want the BlackBerry anymore, told their bosses this. Bosses delighted, didn't have to buy BlackBerries for anyone. IT directors the world over having collective heart attacks because these other phones just weren't as secure as the BlackBerry. So the idea with the new BlackBerry system is that it will be as appealing to consumers that they will be able to use it as their main phone, and IT directors will be delighted because it will be as super secure as the BlackBerry's always have been.
So is that the main selling point of the new operating system, that it is as user-friendly as its rivals but with BlackBerry security?
I would say that's a big thing. It's very slick, the new operating system. And the key thing is that it divides your phone in two so that you can have Facebook on it and you can have your private emails, but you can also have your work emails and work programs, and you cannot overlap the two. You can't even see the two together on your screen. So you can't accidentally paste from a work email onto your Facebook account, as I'm sure has happened many times. It's like having two phones in one, I think, is one of their selling points.
But why would all the customers they've lost to Apple and Android come back?
Well, that's the tricky thing.
Yeah.
They've produced... I saw two of the handsets about 6 months ago, and it was behind closed doors, so I have to be slightly careful about what I say about it, but quite a lot of it has leaked. And one of them looks quite like an iPhone, and the other looks quite like the current flagship, the BlackBerry Bold, with a full QWERTY keyboard. And those phones could be attractive enough for consumers. Plus, a lot of companies are going to start buying BlackBerries for their staff again, and staff are going to say, you know what, this is good enough, I don't need two phones.
Samsung have already released a television advertisement making fun of the new BlackBerry before it's even reached the market. Is this an indication that BlackBerry's rivals are maybe a little bit concerned?
Well, they must be, yes. They wouldn't spend money on something if they didn't think that there was virtue in pushing their rival out of the market, for sure. I think it's going to be an uphill struggle, but certainly the software is very slick and has a lot of consumer-friendly bonuses. There's a very clever camera effect where it takes multiple pictures at the same time, and you can adjust parts of the picture so that if you're blinking in one of the pictures, I can wind back to the one where you're not blinking and wind forward to where the person next to you isn't blinking either, and create a much more sophisticated picture. Now, if those elements and the excellent keyboards that they have and a touchscreen effect that they have on it can attract attention, I think they've got quite a strong chance.
The problem they're going to have, though, is surely the consumer who has his iPhone or his Android is thinking that, is it really worth making that transition now, or should I just wait basically for what I have to catch up with what BlackBerry has introduced?
Yeah, and a lot of it is BlackBerry catching up with the iPhone and Android because they really had slipped off the road. But this certainly puts them in pole position or at equal leading position. I think one of the strengths is that, unlike the previous system, BlackBerry are going to have a lot of apps. They're saying they're going to have 100,000 apps available from next week, which for the launch of a new system is a decent number. You should be able to find the apps you really like and a bunch more. So if people, and people seem to be very interested in apps at the moment, are swayed by that and they like the hardware, which is certainly as good as any of the rivals, I think, you know, maybe people will switch.
How damaged is BlackBerry in the immediate term, though, by, I think, a fairly widespread perception that it got a bit left behind, that it is all a bit 2008, and that it is now largely a tool for sort of, you know, school children arranging where to meet later on?
Yes. I think that it is a problem. They must seek to overcome that. You know, I think they've got such strengths in the business sector that will carry them a long way there. And yes, if they can win those teenagers back again who are deserting them, then it's an uphill struggle, but they can do it, I suspect.
Are they planning a sort of massive global advertising blitz to address this?
I'm sure. The big event is next Wednesday in London, and they're keeping the lid on a lot of the features and the hardware they're going to reveal then. But I'm sure this will be the beginning of everyone knowing that BlackBerry are fighting back.
These 100,000 apps you mentioned, which strikes me at least as being about, I don't know, 99,990 more things than any sane person could ever want a telephone to actually do. What are they? Well, I mean, not all 100,000 of them. We've only got, you know, an hour.
But okay. Yes, I won't go through the list alphabetically. I mean, remember that Android and iPhone have 700,000 apps each. A lot of them replicate each other. There's
sure.
Endless to-do list and flatulence simulators and books and so on. But beyond that, there's the things that people use every day, like Facebook and Twitter, were made to work better on a mobile. There's lots of, you know, everything from currency converters to shopping systems so that you can scan the barcode of a CD in HMV and then go and buy it on Amazon, which is obviously part of the
problem. Or perhaps not in HMV anymore.
Yeah, indeed.
For possibly exactly that reason.
Yes, exactly. I think you're right, 100,000 is a lot. It's way more than anyone needs. But if you only had 20,000, as has been the case with different platforms in the past, you don't get the choice of the exact one you want, and you don't get all the big names. BlackBerry are doing their best to make sure they get all the big name games and the big name, certainly the big name business apps that they need.
Looking at it from the business's point of view, though, I mean, it's obviously encouraging that their shares are up 15%, but there is still that killer figure, which they're 90% short of their 2008 peak. And obviously, that's not entirely RIM's fault. That presumably is the peak that was reached shortly before the bottom fell out of absolutely everything. But those investors in RIM who've been desperately holding onto their shares for 5 years, is that 90% ever coming back, do you think?
I think... Well, they will hope so, obviously. I think there is room for it to grow. Who knows? Clearly, BlackBerry has bet the farm on this, and a number of outhouses and so on as well. They need it to succeed. And, you know, this is the position that Nokia was in a year ago. Everyone said their new software and phones was make or break for the company. And it's not quite made it, but it certainly hasn't broken Nokia either. So I imagine we won't know for a year or so.
And just finally, on a personal note, are the new BlackBerry still going to do that incredibly irritating thing of delivering your emails when the BlackBerry wants you to read them rather than when you do?
Yeah, you have hit upon the BlackBerry key feature, which has held it aloft and made it successful over the years. I know it's a bugbear for you, Andrew, but everyone else loves it.
Not for the first time. Literally everybody else in the world but me is wrong. Our tech expert, David Phelan, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. This is James Yule with First in Line. James Yule with First in Line. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
For 1 week every January, the world's bankers and financiers, its presidents and finance ministers, its titans of industry, union leaders and economists all head to Davos, a picturesque town on the banks of a beautiful lake and in the shadow of the snow-capped peaks of the Swiss Alps. And this year, Monocle 24 will be there too, broadcasting live from the World Economic Forum. On Wednesday and Thursday, The Briefing and Midori House will both come live from Davos. Join us as we keep an eye and an ear on the world economy.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here, and you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the films menu on monocle.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. The Marquis de Sade's 120 Days of Sodom is a famously bracing read. It spins a yarn of four rich, idle jerks who incarcerate 46 victims in a castle, among them several children, and subject them to a variety of imaginative sexual abuses. De Sade, who wrote it while banged up in the Bastille in 1785, himself called it the most impure tale that has ever been told since our world began, and that was up against some pretty stiff competition even by the 18th century. Despite, or perhaps this being France because of, the book's grotesque pornographic content, France's National Library is keen, to the tune of about US $5 million, to acquire the original manuscript. Well, joining me now to wonder why is Elaine Schiolino of the New York Times Paris Bureau. Elaine, Bruno Racine, the library's director, has called the work both depraved and a national treasure. Is he right on both counts?
Well, he's certainly right on the depraved side, Andrew, because this is a book that describes pedophilia, necrophilia, incest, torture, rape, murder, infanticide, bestiality, violent anal and oral sex, things that we certainly couldn't publish in our daily newspaper, the New York Times, and I don't even think you could probably announce it on the British airwaves.
Wouldn't it be quicker, easier, and cheaper just to buy a copy of 50 Shades of Grey for everybody in France?
Actually, it's very different, though, because I read both. I want you to know, I did my research. I read both back to back because I wrote another story on the French response to 50 Shades. And the challenge reading the Marquis de Sade is that truly there is nothing erotic about this text. It is just abusive, plain old abuse that would not have even, there would be no question in any of your sort of national reports about, what's his name, Jimmy Savile?
That's him.
It's just pure perversion and depravity, 100%.
Aside from the obvious explanations, which were that de Sade was, one, completely off his trolley, and two, in jail and probably somewhat bored, why did he actually write it? Did he ever sort of elaborate on that?
I think he was quite angry that he had been put into prison by his mother-in-law, who had gotten an act of the king to get him into prison because he had gone off with his mother-in-law's other daughter, his wife's sister. So it was vengeance. It was fantasy. The Marquis de Sade had been arrested and briefly imprisoned several times for violent acts against women, so that it was both reliving memories and living out perverted fantasies.
This $5 million purchase price that's been floated for the original manuscript, where would the money come from?
More than $5 million, Andrew, more than $5 million, yeah. Well, Bruno Racine has done quite a good job raising money from private sources. You know, the Bibliothèque Nationale is a state-run institution, and you certainly can't ask the French taxpayer to pay for this out of his or her taxes. You know, it's bad enough that taxes in France are pretty high. So that he will raise private funds to pay for this, as he did for the Casanova memoirs, which he raised $9.6 million from an anonymous donor.
Is part of the appeal here the not so much the content of 120 Days of Sodom, but the picturesque history of this particular manuscript?
Look, the Marquis de Sade is an important literary figure of the 18th century, and I went through the library and I looked at all of the first editions and manuscripts and illustrated volumes that the library already has on the Marquis de Sade. I mean, many people see this work as a vile story by a woman hating pornographer, but other people feel that it was an important contribution to either the dark side of humanity or existentialism, and the fact that one could write about anything. It's a sort of kind of bizarre free speech.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, it does sort of test one's patience for freedom of expression, certainly. But supposing the purchase went ahead, what would be done with the manuscript? Do they anticipate that it would be a big tourist draw?
It would be a big tourist draw, just as the Bibliothèque Nationale's pornography show a few years back was the biggest draw in the history of the National Library. They put on display hundreds of works of banned books and pornographic objets, brief films, poems, and there was a line, an hour-long line outside the National Library to get in to see all of the forbidden works at the library. They even transformed a metro station into a fake bordello to attract visitors.
I've always liked about the French their complete happiness with cheerfully espousing every stereotype that the British like to hold about them. Who owns this manuscript right now?
I beg your pardon?
This manuscript, the Marquis de Sade manuscript, 120 Days of Sodom, who owns it at the moment?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. It's really, there are two different purported owners. There is the heir to the family that bought the manuscript, but the manuscript was stolen from this family and secreted to Switzerland, where it was purchased by an industrialist who was a collector of erotica. And so his heirs currently hold it there in Switzerland, but it cannot come back to France because there was a court case in France that declared that the rightful owner is the heir to the family. So the two different purported owners are negotiating to sell the manuscript to the Bibliothèque Nationale and share the profit.
Well, hopefully this long and protracted process means we can come back at some point to this hugely entertaining topic. Elaine Ciolino of the New York Times Paris Bureau, thank you very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and this, from the Marquis de Sade's homeland of France, is M83 with Up. That was M83 with Up. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, or rather you were listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, because that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer Phil Han, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Alex Funnell. Up next after the news is this week's edition of Section D, in which we're sending our Paris correspondent Tom Burgess Watson off to make his own fragrance.
This is my own creation.
And it is definitely really interesting.
Interesting.
3 hours from now, that's 2200 hours London time, Ted Kravitz and Nancy Durham will be back for the Monocle Daily. And tomorrow night, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield will be hosting a special edition of Midori House live from the World Economic Forum in Davos. But for now, from me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye.